And my next guest is Nate Downey. I've dubbed him this morning the Prince of Permaculture. Nate is the author of two books, Harvest the Rain and Roof Reliant Landscaping, and he writes a monthly column, Permaculture in Practice, that has appeared in the Santa Fe, New Mexican since 1998. Nate and his wife, landscape architect Melissa McDonald, own two landscape architecture firms, Santa Fe Permaculture and Permadesign. And their work has been featured in a lot of magazines, Sunset, Sucasa, the Santa Fe, and Haciendas, New Mexico Magazine. So welcome, Nate.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Hollis.
I'm afraid to push your button because I know you're just going to go. but let's start out by talking about the wind and what's happening now. And what does that do to our landscape?
Oh, April is the cruelest month. And it's not just because it's tax season. It's because of our incredible winds this time of year. And those of us who are trying to cover up our vegetables and fruit tree blossoms overnight found some of those plastic sheets blown off. Normally, they don't start this early in the morning either. Right now, they were just blaring on my walk over here. And the funny thing about that is the erosion caused by wind is really more significant over time than the erosion caused by our monsoons. So it's just this constant, you know, people get grit in their teeth and in their eyes, and it's, I've had people just cry on my shoulder when they've realized where they've moved to, and they bought the house in November, and suddenly, you know, there's an inch of sort of dirt on their front door.
Dirt and elm seeds.
Oh, yeah. Billions.
I looked outside and it looked like it had snowed, and I realized it's the elms behind my fence.
Yes. Yeah. And then those fruit tree blossoms, too, if we get, you know, dipped down. Now, don't think it got too cold last night, but we have one coming up tonight that we've got to prepare for.
And how cold, how dangerous is that cold? I mean, how cold does it have to get for us to worry about the fruit trees?
Well, of course, there's microclimatic factors that you have to figure out. If you're house is protecting your plant material, perhaps with the heat emanating from it or from as a windbreak, those plants can last longer. If you water the night before, that'll actually help. Some people don't know that. There's a great story by Chekhov where the opening scene is the entire, you know, community taking buckets of water and just dumping it on the trees, and not just on the root systems, and that does help because that gets the tree active, but really on top of the leaves
foliage?
And the, yes,
wow.
To coat, because it acts as a sort of barrier. First, you have to freeze that water before you can freeze that which is under it. And so that will sometimes be enough. Really, they say, you know, 32 shouldn't be too bad if it's just a brief 32. Mm-hmm. But a brief 29, a brief 28 can certainly do it.
Yeah, so cover up what you can. And weigh it down with rocks.
Yep.
Because of this wind.
Yeah, we use a lot of those binder clips that you get from the office supply stores.
Oh, how clever.
And they work pretty well. But yeah. Rocks, lots of rocks.
Yeah. So let's talk about how we can protect our soil and our plants from the erosion caused by wind and also by rain.
Okay.
Talk about, you know, I've read your book, Harvest the Rain, and there are so many cool ideas in there.
Thank you.
Yeah, so maybe... Well,
yeah, the windbreak one is a good one. People don't think of windbreaks as a means of harvesting moisture, but insofar as that they prevent that erosion that we talked about earlier and evaporation from wind, they are an excellent technique. Although, really, to do a windbreak right, they're often more of a system than a technique, a real strategy, a long-term view of your property that you're going to say, okay, if we're going to create a windbreak here, the best kind of windbreak is made out of trees. And the best kind of windbreak made out of trees is actually made out of four rows of trees. And so, yes, you have to kind of really do it right. You have to zigzag those rows so the wind can't come through and underneath, and you have to choose the right species, and you start with the species that are shorter in front on the direction from the wind, and then the mid-sized trees, and then the tallest trees, and then you have a sort of a medium-high row of trees where
closest to your house,
closest to wherever you're the garden or the
or
house
the garden, yeah.
Exactly, so that the wind that is moving gradually through the foliage and often the conifer branches, because evergreen windbreaks are much more effective in this part of the world because very little has leafed out by the time we get our April winds. But if you set it up in this proper organizational system, the wind can shoot up this sort of ramp and then does not drop down into a void. Nature abhors a vacuum. But with some breeze filtering through, not a strong one, not a devastating one, filtering through the windbreak, that will hold up the prevailing wind and have it continue. And that is something people understand. Sometimes a wall will work great as a windbreak, but inevitably, wherever you put that wall up, or because you put that wall up, some more serious spiral, they call it the Venturi effect, will be created somewhere else on your property or maybe your neighbor's property. So that another important thing to realize is, too, wind doesn't blow, it sucks. And so it's sometimes what's on the other, where you think the wind is going toward is actually having sometimes more of an effect than where the wind is coming from. And so there's lots of factors involved. And in a small situation, an impervious windbreak is a good way to go if you don't have room for all those trees.
So, I mean, basically it takes a little bit of knowledge of physics and aerodynamics. You know, you're trying to create a certain flow of the wind to alter the flow of the wind around your home and your gardens and things so it doesn't erode the soil.
True. Physics.
And dry up the water, right?
Right. Yeah. Physics, definitely, and also sort of intuition. I mean, some of these things we in a way, permaculture is nothing new, and it's just asking the right questions of people so that they realize that they already know the answers.
Oh, interesting.
It is. It's definitely, it's a funny thing to teach because it's really, in a way, common sense. Mm-hmm. And so all you have to do is put these sort of natural principles and natural patterns out in front of people, and people just start to get it and invent their own techniques that are perhaps better than anything any other expert has ever come up with. Because it's really reading the land with a sort of natural language of these patterns. Spiral is one of them, with that Venturi effect. You have to know where that spiral is going to end up. And the layering effect of those trees is another one. Mm-hmm. And so we mimic natural patterns and we become productive and efficient at the same time.
So I'm talking with Nate Downey, the Prince of Permaculture here. And Nate, you say that harvesting rain with rain barrels, the ubiquitous rain barrels in Santa Fe, isn't actually the best way to harvest rainwater.
It's kind of a good start. It's sort of the training wheels of water harvesting, and people can be effective at them. I've had some clients who are very excellent at getting their sump pump out right after a rain and even during a rain, because 1,000 square feet of roof will fill up a 50-gallon rain barrel about 132 times in an average year. So you have to be clairvoyant as to when you're going to remove that water. Oh, it just rained, I don't need to water. But if you don't remove it when it's full, it's just more about where that barrel overflows. And that's what you really have to consider, soaking that water, directing that water so that it soaks into the soil, is sometimes much more effective than just sort of having it sit around in a weed, in a barrel where the mosquitoes can get going. But the next step up, after you have these training wheels, maybe you've had some rain barrels for a couple of years and you've gotten some benefit out of them, but sometimes you pass them on to your neighbor and let them use. The next thing really is a cistern, or that is, if you can afford it. It's an expensive proposition typically to store a lot of water, and to store it underground is the best way in these cold climates, so that can get expensive as well. But a tank underground where you can pump the water to your plants whenever you want is an excellent way to go. The passive water harvesting techniques of the pumice wick and swales and mulching are also excellent, and they're much less expensive.
Yeah, let's talk about pumice wicks.
Sure. Okay, well, what I like to say now is I no longer call them pumice wicks.
Right.
They're growstone wicks, which is made out of recycled glass. Okay, for the last 7 years, Santa Fe, or for 7 years prior to 3 years ago, let's put it that way, Santa Fe had been piling up glass with nobody buying it.
Recycled glass. You mean the
Absolutely.
Glass we put in our little blue bins.
Thank you, mm-hmm. Yes. And so the truck comes by, they put it in the truck, they drive it to this pile, and they dump it there. No one, we're out in the middle of nowhere. What are we going to do with it? This Santa Fe-based company actually started a big plant down in Albuquerque with the plan of using Albuquerque's recycled glass and turning it into this man-made pumice. And what happened to them was their deal somehow fell through with the city of Albuquerque, and they're getting it back going on track. But in the meantime, and for the last 3 years, they've been harvesting Santa Fe's glass and turning it into this product that we can use as basically a sponge underground. So water comes off the roof, flies out of a canale or drops down a downspout and into a little trench that is diverted away from the house. The trench has then got a pipe in the middle of it, perforated, and then around that is basically a sausage of this very lightweight but strong stone that can absorb up to 50% of its volume
the glass.
In water. Yes, and it's really no longer glass anymore. It's silica. It's glass and lots of air.
It's like sand in a way. Isn't sand silica?
Yes, but it's heated up and blown full of this air that allows for the water then fill in those pores. And they use it in the hydroponic industry, and they use it where people typically put in perlite or vermiculite or pumice into potting soil. And the great thing about this grow stone is that you don't harvest it from the mountains. The Jemez Mountains have been for many, hundreds of years maybe, or at least decades, a major source of pumice. And that's all well and good, local product, etc., except the way it's mined is not good for our rivers. And so I used to use it quite a bit, and it had amazing effects in the landscapes locally here in Santa Fe, but I did feel a little bit guilty. Now I don't have to feel guilty anymore.
So this company, you're calling it Growstone, G-R-O-W?
Yep.
Growstone, and it's recycled glass, and when they recycle it, they pump air into it so that it becomes a porous, pumice-like material.
Exactly.
So, okay, so let's review, because I have to conceptualize this as well as the audience. So water comes off the roof, it goes down a canale, comes down a pipe of some kind, or it splashes into...
Yeah, it looks like a little pile of rocks, and under that is a actual conical shaped, a very low conical funnel that goes into a little drain box, and then from there the pipe directs it to where you want.
Underground.
Underground.
It's all underground. Once it comes off the roof and splashes down onto the pile of rocks, it goes underground.
That's very important.
And then this perforated pipe goes along underneath maybe your trees, your garden.
It's especially good to use before you've planted a lot of trees. Mm-hmm. You don't want to necessarily come
disrupt
through an established landscape with this, although it would probably be fine. It would just be more work to chop through a lot of roots. But it's great for new landscaping projects where you can plant it in advance. You know where your plants are going to go, and you can zigzag this sponge underground. It's an 8-inch wide by 20-inch deep by however long you think it'll work long. And so you can zigzag that around your landscape and your plant on either side of it, typically not on top unless you have a 2-inch root system on top. And plants just love it. They thrive. The roots suckle up to this sausage full of moisture and can really make it during the tough times and thrive in the wet times.
Well, your neighbors might start turning you in for excess use of water
if
you had those through your landscape.
Well, that brings up an important point, because there's a major misconception that other states think that, if all these people in New Mexico or Texas in particular are harvesting water from their roof, and then it's not going to go into the Rio Grande and we're not going to get what's due to us. Well, the problem with that theory is that what these water harvesting sites do is they slow the flow of water, they allow percolation into the aquifer, and they prevent particulate and basically pollution getting into our river, our arroyos, and then our river systems. Because when rain comes down, normally in the native state, it would absorb into the soil to a degree. But now it hits our roads, it hits our roofs, and all these impervious surfaces. And regardless of all the gasoline and oil on the roads, just even on a roof, you have mass times momentum. That force in one place will create an erosive situation, and that soil ends up in the water, and then the fish can't live in that. Typically the water changes temperature when you have more particulate in it, and species start dying out, and it becomes more of a problem.
So in the long run, we're all doing better and getting more water by practicing good harvesting procedures. And
absolutely.
And it also reduces evaporation, like the pumice wick the non-pumice wick, when you're sending that water underground to feed your plants.
Much
more
efficient.
It's not sitting on the top and then evaporating into the atmosphere, right?
That's another great point. It's much more efficient.
So I saw something else in your book that's really seemed to me a very interesting method, Baker's rock tubes.
Oh, yeah. We used to call these deep pipe irrigation. And we would have one little pipe full of either gravel or pumice next to a plant, one or two. And it would be a way of getting water down deeper into the root zones. But my friend Reese Baker had developed this idea of, instead of using all this extra pipe, which is resource and PVC and
putting plastic in the ground, not a good idea.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and especially where PVC is fabricated. It's carcinogenic and a dangerous substance. And so Reese's idea is to use one piece of pipe as a template, and then you use the rest as you hold that gravel next to the basically a skinny cylinder of gravel, maybe the vertical version of a pumice wick, because pumice wicks are horizontal. This would be a vertical version of that. You keep the pipe in there just temporarily. As you remove the pipe, this weed barrier fabric then holds that gravel in place, and then you put your plant in, and it's a great way to prevent sort of wasting water on the surface, as you were just referring to. Drip irrigation is a wonderful technique, but it's really great when you can get that drip into a baker's tube, because then the water goes dribbling down and encourages deeper root growth.
Yeah, and you can't see the pipe.
Oh, no.
You know, it doesn't mar the landscape in any way.
Unless your mulch blows away. You always want to add mulch.
Right.
I always really like to stress the easiest thing to do to harvest the rain is to get some mulch onto around your plants, and that'll insulate the soil, that'll keep moisture from evaporating, and build the soil so that microorganisms can thrive.
Now, you don't sell mulch, right?
No.
Okay, so since you don't sell mulch, tell us what's the best kind of mulch to use.
Well, my favorite is straw, and it's not for everybody, but one thing to realize, if you don't disintegrate that bale of straw too much, but you want to do it enough so that moisture can get through, but if you keep it in kind of a matrix, it won't blow away. It's actually like a web on the ground. So bark is another great one. Shredded bark is easily available here, not too expensive, in bulk especially. One of the surprising mulches is gravel. You know, you'd think it's, well, some people do really think it's ugly, but you can do it with different colors, and you can use plants in a certain way that, you know, softens that gravel. What's great about gravel is it actually harvests moisture from the air, and the Dene people from this part of the world hundreds of years ago used gravel and rock as mulch. It heats up during the day, and our convection at night, our quick changes in temperature, creates moisture. Of course, that's why when you lift up a rock in nature, you find moisture.
And worms.
Yes.
And crickets and all kinds of little creatures. Yeah. So so you can just use gravel or like river rock or something in the basin of a tree, for example.
Absolutely.
And that will help, at least.
Absolutely. It'll also control erosion, too. So when you do go to water with a hose, perhaps, you're not disintegrating the soil layer on top, which should be as protected as possible. So yes, I'm a big fan of river rock, gravel, straw. If you can get compost, great, but that can be quite expensive, and that will blow away. So sometimes you want to put compost underneath something less expensive.
Mm-hmm. Or put down, maybe you put down straw and then put rock on top of it? Or
yeah, you can get into weed issues with straw. With gravel. Uh-huh. So straw can bring in some weeds, and so that's one thing you got to know about straw. It's typically annual weeds from the straw itself.
Yes.
So you get those before they come to grow into seeds, and then you just throw them back under the mulch. That green manure will act as extra nitrogen for your plants, but then you typically won't have weed problems after that if your mulch is thick enough.
Oh, great. And what about, so there's also something you call the Santa Fe drain.
Yeah, that's goes back to a question of what is a French drain. A lot of people feel like the French drain needs to have a pipe in it, and some people feel that it's just a dry well. And so in my book, I decided to invent a term called the Santa Fe drain. I'm not sure that it's taken off, but thank you for bringing it up. But I do, in our work, we put water into pipes and direct it toward places far away, say from houses, to get drainage functioning for structures. And that's one kind of French drain. Another kind of French drain is just a hole filled with rubble next to a plant. And whenever it rains, it goes into that hole and kind of acts as one of those Baker rock tubes. It's a little less fancy.
Oh, interesting. So you just could do that. Just dig a hole next to...
Yeah. Sometimes I put the rocks inside a cardboard box. Worms love the glue of corrugated cardboard. So as that decays, yes, talk about basically a worm farm. And if you place these correctly, such that they're the first places near a tree or a shrub that will get runoff, then you are getting water right to the root zones of those plants and really doing a lot with very little.
What else? What else are you recommending? What's new in the world of permaculture design?
Oh, wow. There are... I think something important that people really need to realize is with a lot of renovation going, a lot of this 50s construction is coming to an end, and we're seeing a lot of concrete going to the dump. Instead of sending that to the dump, we should use what we call urbanite, chopped up concrete, to build really quick and easy retaining walls. I mean, now, it's not so quick and easy to chop up concrete, but if you've got to remove it anyway, you're going to have to do some chopping. And so if you chop up concrete into squares, or anything resembling a square, they're typically similar in thickness. And the pour of concrete is very often 4 inches. That means that these can be stacked very easily and quickly on top of each other and work as retaining walls. They can also work as check dams in arroyos very effectively. And so that's something I think is important. Another sort of maybe used to be top secret, and it was just out in the paper yesterday, is the use of drones. I do think that if people were to use drones for certain types of situations, you could save a lot of money with landscape design. And that's something I'm looking at right off the bat in terms of new technologies.
I'm trying to figure out how a drone is going to help me with landscape design.
Okay, well, my rate is, when we can't say it on the radio, is expensive. But if I were to be able to send a drone to somebody and they said, you know, here, take it out to your front door, push a button, send it up, put it back in the box when it's done, and provide me with not only imagery but other data, I could then design a landscape with that assistance pretty quickly and easily without having the extra drive time and the gasoline to get out of place. And some of these applications are pretty remote for this kind of technology. I don't think it's going to be happening in downtown
tomorrow.
Santa Fe anytime soon. And the first thing that any company that would start this would want to do would be to make sure that the neighbors were informed beforehand.
Right.
Really.
We're not spying on you.
And
it's our it's our land we're spying on. Yeah.
And that for 10 minutes, this thing at 10 a.m. is going to go up, and it's going to come back, and it's going to be over. Don't worry.
Right.
And so I think that would be a big part of a successful marketing campaign.
I can see privacy issues and the ACLU getting involved in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Nate, we only have a few minutes left. You've been long involved in legislation and lobbying for better laws that have to do with the environment. What's on your plate right now? What are you working on?
Well, I don't know what it's going to be called at next session, but last session we had SB 16, which was tax credits for water harvesting systems. It passed two committees. Actually, only got one vote against out of the 14, 15, 16 votes for. And then it just, in a 30-day session, it was the first time that this bill had ever been introduced. It didn't make it past a finance committee. So if anybody knows John Arthur Smith, please let me know.
Is he the chairman of that committee?
Yes. We have to talk to him and make him see that the water harvesting industry could bring good, solid jobs to New Mexico, just like the active and photovoltaic solar industries have done.
So you're talking about tax credits for businesses in the water harvesting
arena. Sorry, actually tax credits for people who install cisterns.
Individuals, individual people and or businesses?
Individual people
was the initial aim.
Uh-huh. And, of course, we want to get our foot in the door and make it bigger than that. But one interesting thing that was part of the bill, too, is that you could transfer those tax credits. So if you weren't going to have a reason to have any tax credits, but you still wanted a cistern, you could actually sell those on a kind of market. And there'd be a little middleman taking 10% off to deal with the system. But then someone who needed the tax credit could get it by supporting your system. and buying your credit.
I kind of love that.
Yeah, and I think that's what happens with the photovoltaic industry right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's nothing new. It's just sort of doing what we do with the photovoltaic industry with the water harvesting industry.
So at the next session, you anticipate reintroducing that law or something similar, getting somebody to introduce it for you?
Well, I bet you Peter Wirth would like to do it again.
He did it again.
And we'll plug away. We'll probably want to find some support on the other side of the aisle, get some more support in the House. And this was, I wouldn't say a last-minute thing, but I saw the draft of the bill about a week before it came out.
So that's a little short.
I think we're gonna build on this wisely in the interim.
Yeah, you have to work the public and let the public know about it, so the public can go to their legislators and tell them they want that bill passed. It's a long process.
Yes, and when I'm being interviewed, I make sure the person asks me.
I've been talking with Nate Downey. Nate's websites are permadesign.com and sfpermaculture.com.